Today I'm joined by Paul Wood, a prominent board member of the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering. Paul brings a pragmatic perspective to the growing field of cultivated meat. While supportive of innovation, he emphasises the challenges around scalability, cost and market adoption for cultivated meat, often a sobering voice amongst the throng of techno excitement. I'm Alex Crisp and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. Please do subscribe to the Substack or YouTube pages to catch all future and past episodes. Okay, so thank you, Paul Woods, for coming on the Future of Foods Interviews. This is a slightly different flavour in a way, because you are perhaps, well, not the first. I did interview Liz Webster, who was a cattle farmer in the UK, and her opinions on cultivated meat were also not aligned with a lot of the entrepreneurs and the scientists and people from the Good Food Institute. Paul Woods is an Australian scientist and entrepreneur with major contributions to biotechnology and veterinary science. You were awarded the Officer of the Order of Australia for contributions to veterinary science and leadership in biotechnology. So clearly you have a good understanding of the science and you have a very strong a position, I suppose, on sort of cultivated meats, commerciality and kind of chances of success. So could you just sort of provide us a little introduction of yourself?
Yep, sure.
Thank you.
So I wear a lot of different hats at the moment. I'm an adjunct professor at Monash University, but my training originally was a PhD in cellular immunology in Canberra at the Australian National University. I worked with CSIRO, our national research organisation, for about 13 years as a scientist and end up inventing something that became rather significant. I ended up inventing a new way to diagnose tuberculosis, which is now the standard of care around the world. So that was nice as a young scientist. I moved across into industry with companies like CSL in Australia, and eventually they sold the animal health division to Pfizer. I ended up in the US as head of global discovery for Pfizer Animal Health. So, you know, probably two decades or so in the sort of corporate industry, where, you know, biotech was the fundamental. We made vaccines, we made monoclonal antibodies, so large scale fermentation was pretty important. I stepped out of that around 2012 and came back to Australia, and since then I've worked across a broader area of agriculture, from things like 6 years on the Australian Dairy Board. I'm the chair of an insect farming company. We make pet treats. I'm on the global the scientific oversight committee for the Global Methane Hub. So we have $200 million US to spend on research to reduce methane emissions from livestock. And then I act as an advisor to various for-profit and not-for-profit groups.
Okay, that's interesting. You say you have $200 million to spend on reducing methane.
From enteric methane specifically.
Yeah. So I mean, COP28 last year, obviously that's a big ambition of theirs, and they were talking about it in increasing livestock around the world at the same time as reducing methane. Now, obviously, this will have a lot to do with animal feed. And kind of changing animal feed is that what you're looking at?
Look, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. So the global methane hub came out of COP, out of the sort of, the global methane pledge. This is methane from all sorts of sources, but specifically the what we call the enteric methane accelerator was about enteric methane, so livestock species. And there's lots of different ways. So you can genetically select for low methane producing animals. So if you look at any herd of animals, there'll be probably a 30% difference in methane emissions from the highest and the lowest. So you can select for those lower methane and breed those. So people are already doing that, and we will accelerate that work. You can have compounds that you put into feed that reduce methane. So there's a company called DSM that developed a product. The chemical name is 3NOP, the trade name is Bovaer, and that reduces methane emissions by about 30%. A lot of people have heard about red seaweed, Asparagopsis. So that's out in a number of countries now, and that's about the 50% and above methane reductions. So those are some of the ways. There are other ways. We're funding some work on creating vaccines to reduce methane. I'm chairing a meeting at 10 o'clock tonight talking about that. That's supported by the Bezos Foundation. There are people who are looking to genetically engineer methane producing organisms. And of course, feed. Just, like we know that the quality of feed that you put an animal on has an impact. So there's a lot of different ways that you can reduce methane. Largely at today, if you look at the developing countries, which have probably the most intensive, when I mean that, it's the amount of methane per kilogram of product. By increasing productivity in those countries, you can have a lot of impact. So you can better genetics, reduce mortality and morbidity. I used to chair an organization called GalvMed, which was funded by the Gates Foundation and the UK government. And we work with smallholder farmers in Africa and India. So there's a lot of productivity things you can do in those countries, which will get you gain. So the animal numbers might go up, but the actual methane numbers will go down because you're getting productivity. If you look at dairy today, we produce more milk today with l less numbers than we ever had, and that's through productivity gains.
I suppose so the amount of livestock, I suppose if we're kind of thinking about how much more meat and dairy is going to be needed over the next sort of 5, 10, 20 years, I mean it's going to be kind of significantly more. I mean what's in terms of numbers, I mean how much using the sort of methods that you've just spoken about, how much of a drop in methane can you expect per per head of cattle or per
So the target that, like in Australia, we have a target of being carbon neutral by 2030. So, and a lot of countries have those sort of targets. It's generally around about the 30% reduction. I think the big thing to think about, when you look at folk global security, you really got to look at regional specific. So if you look at the Western world, our populations aren't going to grow. Okay. In most countries, they're going to shrink a bit. Japan, they're going to shrink quite a bit. So the amount of food we need for those people, bearing in mind that we eat too much anyhow. So our biggest problem in the Western world is obesity. And we could afford to eat less of everything, particularly refined sugars, carbohydrates. So there's a lot of things, that are wrong with our diets in the Western world. Yet we're obese. So that, you go to the US and there's so much wrong with the US food system, which is largely around the fact that they're hooked on the issue that quantity is the king. I advertise the amount of food, not the quality of the food or the nutritional value of the food. And the majority of people are eating highly processed food, you know. So there's a lot that needs to change there that could decrease obesity, decrease our improve food nutrition issues, improve nutrition. You look at lower middle income countries, and it's complete opposite. We got 800 million people who have severe nutritional problems. We've got 120 million children who have micronutrient deficiency. In other words, they didn't get the right nutrients in a young age, and they're runted and stunted, and they will never recover from that, you know. And we know in those countries, an egg a day or a glass of milk a day would get rid of micronutrient deficiency. So they actually need more animal-based protein in their diet. And I look at this, you know, it can be meat, it can be dairy. That's key because of the nutrient density of animal-based foods. So their animal numbers are going to go up, and we've got to make sure that they go up in a sustainable fashion. So that's where improvements in productivity are really important.
It's interesting. I mean, do you think? Yes, you're talking about in the West, we eat too much. We eat too much of the wrong sort of food. It's quite a seismic shift to try and change that, isn't it? I mean, it's because you have the marketing companies. I mean, it's all about. People eat what they're told to eat. People eat what they're encouraged to eat. They eat what is affordable for them, what is convenient for them, what tastes nice for them. And so what is marketed to them is over years has become exactly what they want and what has
Yeah,
been
look, big.
pushed upon them. And that is that
Yeah.
going to change?
I think it is. I think the food companies realize they must change. So all of the food companies are trying to get their footprint down. They've stripped out a lot of, type one and type two, greenhouse gas, things. And now they have to go after scope. So I should say scope three. So scope three means they have to go to the farmers and ask them to reduce their environmental footprint. So what they want to do is they want to provide solutions for the farmers because, they don't want to go in with a big stick and say, we aren't going to take your product unless you use. So they're looking for reductions. That's why they're supporting some of this work. But look, to be honest, they've been part of the problem. I mean, the whole creation of the fast food industry turned into a science where they learned how to create food that made people want to eat more of it, increase the salt content,
That's where the
so
profit margin is, isn't it? So, you'd have to remove the wants or the need for profit. And I don't know.
yeah, and that's why, look, the pharmaceutical industry is thriving on these drugs now, the GLP-1 inhibitors, Ozempic and that. They decrease satiety, so you feel fuller, so you don't want to eat as much. But again, the issue of what we eat is a really complex, interesting thing.
Very complex.
Jack Bobo's book on why smart people eat the wrong foods is a really good story about why we do that. It's actually quite complicated. It's what we're told, but it's also a bit of psych. It's a bit of lifestyle issues. It's a bit of, we know it's socioeconomic. We know that people who are, on the margins tend to eat crappy food. Yeah.
It's also how people are raised, isn't it? I've had Jack Bobo on
Yeah.
this program, actually. Yes,
Yeah. Jack is really good. I really, I met him a number of years ago, and I think I recommend his book for anyone who wants to understand how we got ourselves into the problem in the Western world that we're in today. But he also su makes some suggestions about how we can get out of it too.
As part of the as part of the kind of increase in population and the food challenge, do you think cultivated meat has any place in that?
Well, I was sort of, I go along to a lot of pitches and they start off with going, there's going to be 10 billion people in the world and we have to feed them and that. And the point I make is we know where those people are. They're large, that population growth is in Africa and parts of Asia. They're the people we have to feed. We don't need any more food for the Western world. We got plenty. So my question firstly to them is, so is your solution a solution for Africa? Let's just focus on Africa. That's where the biggest population growth is going to be. They're the ones with real problem with food insecurity because they import a lot of food. And when I look at cell-based and precision fermentation, a lot of these technologies, they're expensive tech. The last thing Africa needs is more expensive tech, particularly if they're going to have to import all that technology. So they'll actually become less food secure under this scenario. Because the price of the products will go up. They'll have to import more of it. That's a big problem for them. So I argue that that will make Africa, less food secure. So it's they're not a solution. I got into this argument when I first saw the Rethink X report in 2019 that said, like by 2030, we're going to get rid of all our animals. The dairy industry will have collapsed. And I looked at this and I thought, look, to be honest, I'll use a technical. This is crap. This is people sort of gazing into the future, making assumptions that just are not substantiated by any of the data. So that started me in looking in more depth at what people are claiming. I've been using cell culture, for a long time as part of, making products, but it's expensive. It's, the facilities are expensive. The media is expensive. The salaries are, you're not, there's no one in there that's not degree qualified, So I just felt that this wasn't right. I started to, get some biotech people, particularly people who design facilities, to do some analysis for me. I started talking to Joe Fassler, who wrote that original article in The Counter, and he came across David Humberg's paper, which was very much along the same lines, saying that this is expensive tech. I think David said he couldn't see it getting down under about $50 a kilogram. And remember, it's not actually making a prime steak. It's making hamburgers, sausages, dumplings. I mean, those products are largely offcuts of the great of good cuts. I want a beautiful steak or a nice joint. And as I process an animal, I've got a lot of off-cuts. And what do I use those for? Well, I use them for hamburgers and sausages and
But I suppose this
things.
is
So
all, I suppose it's still very early days, isn't it? And clearly the technology, the cost of technology will come down, and clearly the quality of the product will go up. And
look, I hope, I don't know,
yeah.
because if, to be honest, it's going, let's just deal with quality firstly. I mean, the original concept of cellular meat was I take muscle cells and I grow them out and then I differentiate them to microfibers. And I produce sort of a muscle-like product. People have abandoned that largely. One or two companies are keeping with it, but largely it's they found out, well, that's hard to do. It's expensive. I'm just going to grow cells up as a single cell sort. Culture, I'm going to create a cell slurry and I'm going to blend it with plant-based products. So that's not the original concept. That to me, that's a downgrading of the original concept. If you talk about costs, yeah, costs are going to come down. The original first hamburger in 2013, what was that?
I think
300,000 euros.
200,000 or something, yes.
Well, the thing is,
Milan.
everything's going to come. Yeah, everything is going to come down, but and people sort of talk about, that's the nature of technology. But I'll flip it and I'll do a bottom-up calculation. So let's assume you can get your media costs down to $1 a liter. Okay, that's a big ask, $1 a liter. And considering how complex that media is.
I think people are sort of getting to that now, aren't they? They're sort of leaning.
People are claiming it, but I'll hold my fire when I look at the complex because some people are saying, oh, I'm going to do that by using plant-based materials for my amino acids and that. And what I'll tell you is that your quality of your manufacture is going to suffer. I mean, when you're a manufacturing person, you want absolute certainty about that your cells will hit a particular density in a certain sort of materials and that. Your viability, your quality of your manufacturing decreases. And we see that even in the papers that are being published today. We're seeing that the length of culture to doubling time is increasing, etc. But let's just assume a dollar. Okay, let's assume they can get to a dollar. Then how much media do they use per kilogram of product? Now, I'll be very generous and say it's 10 liters. Those who are using continuous cell culture, it's going to be 20 liters, 30 liters. Okay, so that's $10 a kilogram. At scale, and this is what most of these people don't understand, they don't understand much about scale. Media is about 20% of your cost of goods because of the facility that you have to build, the equipment in there. So now I'm at $50 a kilo, and I'm making hamburgers and I'm making sausages. So if you do a bottom-up calculation, and I'm being very generous when I say you can get to a dollar a liter and you get to 10 liters a kilogram, it's why we've seen so many of the companies who sprout who made big announcements about we're going to go to 250,000 liters. Now, that was an irresponsible statement because we'd never scaled. About 25,000 liters is about where the monoclonal antibody industries are tapped out for a lot of different reasons. I'll give you one very simple one. If I've got 250,000 liters and I lose a batch, imagine how many millions of dollars that is. Now, I don't make anything as a manufacturer without having pre-sold it. So imagine what happens to those customers who are waiting for that product. So as a manufacturer, you would never do that, even if you technically could. So again, this is what annoys me about some of these people who are hyping the market. And that one's crashed and burned in a big way.
I suppose losing a batch is the equivalent of having to sort of kill all your stock because they've got mad cow disease or something, isn't it?
Look, it can be. It's why biosecurity is a critical. If you farm, biosecurity is a critical issue. I mean, people say, "Oh, look, we'll get rid of the animals because we'll protect ourselves from all these new and emerging diseases." Well, most of them come out of wildlife. COVID didn't come out of cattle or pigs or that. Even flu, which people like to quote, what moves flu around the world? It's bird species. It's wild bird species. It's ducks. So, yes, we do have some problems that cross over, but they're quite rare. So I get annoyed when people butcher the science for the sake of telling their story.
But there
We've got to
are,
protect.
I mean, clearly there are a lot of scientists, a lot of entrepreneurs. There are lots of, lots of money, time, PhDs, people investing their lives into this science, and so they believe it can be a commercial success. And I mean,
Look,
I'm not
I've yet,
assuming. I'm not
yeah,
assuming
I've yet
that
to.
they're just putting this stuff together so they can get a capital raise and then sort of retire early, are they?
Well, I've spoken to so many people who have so little knowledge about biotech, and when I go and sit and I talk to biotech people and I ask them, what do you think about what's going on? Even some who are advisors early on, who just say, well, these people aren't listening to us, We told them about scale. We told them about facilities. So, to be honest, there's more hype out there than there is science. And if you ask about cost, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has been using this technology for decades. We've been working very hard to get our costs down. We know about facilities now. We use a lot of less stainless steel, more disposable materials, etc. There's a size you can go up to for that. So, and we've spent a lot more. $3 billion have gone into cellular ag. We've probably spent tens of billions of dollars in this. I mean, all the major drugs out there in the world are monoclonal antibodies. So the industry has spent time and energy to understand this tech. And these guys come along and go, "Oh, what do you guys know? We can grow to 250,000 liters. We can, they'll grow in water,
I
you know."
suppose
I
there's a
mean,
difference. I suppose there's a slightly different incentive, isn't there? With the pharmaceuticals, they are not necessarily trying to get their product down as cheap as possible to be at price parity with a very cheap product. But and if they had a bit, perhaps they would have come up with a much cheaper way of scaling things.
well, there's 2 points to that. One is I worked out in the animal health industry. Products have to be relatively cheap. We use monoclonal antibodies. We were some of the first to introduce it to cats and dogs, etc. So they're big products that out there. Cost of goods are really important. So this issue, the pharmaceutical industry doesn't care about costs. Well, it does care about costs. Yeah, that one is really a rather spurious sort of argument.
I mean,
I forget.
I've heard that the kind of pharmaceutical industry are now looking at technology, which has been developed more recently in regard, as a result of the money put into the cell agriculture industry, to develop their pharmaceuticals more cheaply.
Look, although they'll definitely look at it, I've not seen any of it up, any of it taken up today. But obviously, if tech comes out of it, I mean, remember the pharmaceutical industries are pretty good at surveying what's going on out there, and they'll take things up. But what they won't take up is things that bring variability into manufacture. So some of the things that people are talking about that are going to increase variability, things like, oh, we won't need all that standard of laboratory that you guys use. Now, that all those standards like filtering air, they're to protect the cells from us. Okay, that's there. If you don't filter the air coming into your factory, you are going to have fungus everywhere. So again, these are sort of things that people come out and make statements. I mean, the more recent group I've been arguing with, oh, we're going to make, you know, we're going to new industry for farmers. We'll have cell culture systems running on farms. It makes no sense. There's no skill set that a farmer has that
That
translates
respect
across.
farms. Is that respect farms you're
Yeah,
talking about there?
that yeah. It's to be honest, it's just a massive distraction for people who have very little concept of what it takes to do this. I mean, these are sophisticated facilities. Staff in sort of, full PPE, lots of stainless steel. Why stainless steel? Well, because it's really easy to clean, and we use harsh chemicals to strip all that biolayer off there. Some people said, "Oh, we'll use lower grade stainless steel." And there was quite an interesting debate. Liberation Labs in the US are doing one of the best. They know what they're talking about, so they had a bit of debate going, and they said, "No, we're not." I mean, we don't want pitting in our stainless steel. That's where bugs get a little niche in there. So, there's so many of these arguments that come out as sort of so-called people who know what they're talking about.
Well, I haven't heard people wanting to kind of cut corners on the side, because clearly when you start cutting corners, that's when it's gonna things are going to go wrong, isn't it? And I would assume people are not going to want to risk upsetting the whole process and their whole business on cutting corners on their hardware. And I mean,
Well,
doesn't sound
I'm
very
seeing it all the time. People talking about lower quality facilities, cheaper materials, lower quality, inputs. And it gets a bit frustrating after a while. I mean, the groups that I think it's saying the honesty is companies like Vow, who are one of the few actually selling product today. In Singapore, they said it's expensive. They priced it around $100 a kilogram, and they're in high-end restaurants.
And
And
they're selling quail, aren't they, Val?
they've got a quail product. I was in Singapore in May, and I went out with George, the CEO, and tried these products in some of these restaurants where you've got rock star chefs. And they were nice. So But they're at least, I think, telling the truth. The ones that say we'll get to price parity, I honestly, I just keep asking, tell me how. I just like, they'll say, oh, we're decreasing it, but I'll do my bottom up calculation to them. Then we get into the whole nutrition issue. And it's like, so where are you? What's the nutrition? Oh, well, we'll add in these things. Well, part of the issue, the special thing about meat is that the bioavailability of those nutrients is exquisite. So, the uptake of for iron from meat is sevenfold that from most of the plant-based materials. So you can't, it's not just a, like a Lego block. So I'll add a red one and a white one and I'll throw in some minerals. That's not how biology works. So they are going to have a challenge on nutrition. People say, oh, but I'm making Wagyu. I'm making Wagyu. And I go, hang on, I'll show you what a Wagyu steak's like. It's all that interstitial fat. It's a three-dimensional. You're making a cell line. Like that's not Wagyu steak. How do you age? This is another one. This is a one I love. If you go and talk to people who are into the meat science, we know that the aging of meat adds a lot to the flavor and the taste and the texture. How do you age a cell culture? How do, and that's the reality. When people say, "Oh, but we're making an identical product," you're not making an identical product. I've got no problem with people selling product. I think this sort of thing of bans that we're seeing in some countries and some parts, that's just political, stuff. It's ridiculous. You're giving free publicity. I'm not against, I don't agree with
So I
bans
mean,
at all.
I've spoken to some scientists who sort of say that you can age a product and you can you can kind of give the product more bite by putting some stress factor on the cells as they're being produced, like a stress component. I'm not sure exactly how that works because I'm not a scientist.
Well, go and ask a cell, a muscle biologist what stress looks like. We've done a lot of work on hanging steak, how you hang it, how you stress it. We put electric, currents through it. There's a whole, people have been decades of science about what makes a good steak, and, it's nothing to do with the cell. It's to do with the fibers.
So it sounds to me, Paul, like you are, that you're not against the science. You're not against kind of cultivated, sort of cellular agriculture as a concept, as an idea. You just think that people are perhaps overselling it in the short term, but you do perhaps accept that it, in the long term, it has a viable chance
Oh,
of
look, I think
being
it.
part of the solution.
I think they'll be high-valued products in niche markets. I've been writing this since the start. I'm a scientist. I love tech, so the science works. We culture cells. We've been doing it for decades, and we make products out of them. There'll be some high-value products like foie gras and that people will make, or like what Vow's making. A product that goes into high-end restaurants. But to sort of suggest that they're going to replace livestock, to suggest that they're going to have an environmental impact. I mean, let's just environmental impact for a while. We disagree amongst the various life cycle analysis being done, but where they do agree is that the energy costs are fivefold greater. And that's to intensive animal production. The majority of livestock are not intensive. I mean,
Is
people
this
focus on the US.
the AC Davis report that's kind of said about
No, not so much.
mentioned?
Well, there's a few. There's the Sinkey sort of report that was done with GFI, but there's been a few
I
different
mean, it's in
reports now.
dispute, isn't it? Well,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Look,
not exactly
the
accepted.
problem with life cycle analysis at the moment is when you don't actually have a manufacturing facility at scale, all you do is you make a whole lot of assumptions. So all that the reports do today is reflect the assumptions you make. But the energy bit is real. The energy bit is consistent across lots of reports. Now, this is what killed the vertical farming. They would make all these vertical farms. Then when energy costs went up, they had to turn the lights out. So, and I said, this is at the moment, those reports are to intensive European and US. The vast majority of livestock are on natural pastures. 87% of what livestock eat is not digestible by humans. It's grasses. They take grasses on largely non-arable land and they turn it into products that we can eat. So they're the great recyclers. If you think about plants that we grow, corn and all these, the majority of that product, that crop we grow, is bio waste. We eat the seeds. So it's sort of, it depends on the crop, but it's sort of about 15 to 20% of a crop is actually eaten by humans. And the rest, what do we do with it? We feed it to animals.
But
And the animals.
we're talking about changing the feed of the animals, aren't they, to
But if they but they're saying, oh,
eat.
we'll take that land and we'll crop it. Well, firstly, most of it's non-arable, so you can't crop it. And then where you crop it, what are you going to do with the bio waste? Okay, we would feed it to animals today. What are you going to do? In Africa, this is a really important part. I mean, 25% of manure is livestock. 25% or more of the draft power is livestock. So people, it annoys me that they don't look, they're talking about global security and they actually don't look at the countries that really matter.
I mean, you know, I mean, I have never thought that the idea of producing sort of cellular agriculture and sort of cell-cultivated meat is a way of replacing livestock. I mean, I've only ever seen it as a way of sort of filling a potential increased demand, because there clearly is going to be an increased demand. And if there's a more efficient way of producing it, yes, it might be more kind of high-end products, or kind of sausages, or kind of meat that doesn't need a scaffold. This stuff that you get in your chicken nuggets and your fish fingers, all of that stuff. If there's a more efficient way of producing that, then I think that should be encouraged. I mean, do you agree with that or not?
Well, firstly, it's context specific. We don't need any more food for the Western world. Okay. So the place where we need
But if we
food.
can produce the same food more efficiently.
Okay. Again, I'm all for that. But then we can get into an argument about what efficiency looks like. And fish and chicken, the efficiencies of those species, is enormous. Some of the arguments about efficiency, it
Okay,
depends
well,
on what
beef
sort,
then, I suppose,
are we
because beef
talking
is very
about,
inefficient, isn't it, at the
yeah,
moment?
okay.
Cow is.
Well, depending on what we're defining as life as
Yeah.
inefficient, as I said, the majority of livestock are on non-arable land, so they take products we can't eat and they turn into products we can eat. Okay. So that's quite inefficient. They eat a lot of the biomass of the world that we, when we grow crops, is fed to animals and they turn it into things that we can eat. To me, that's a pretty efficient system. Then
But
you can
that
argue, okay.
biomass can also be fed to a bioreactor in the same way, can't it?
If you do the calculations on the quantity of biomass, no. Yes. At the moment, like biogas and things like that, we take waste products in that. But there's some really good calculations around about global biomass. The places like the RIDDIT Institute in New Zealand have done some really nice modeling around global biomass. But to go back to your point, there are groups that for them, this is really a way of attacking livestock. I just have to admit it. I mean, the global, the sort of just transition groups out of Europe. It's people who don't see, who don't want to actually understand that in a global food system, livestock are part of it. Okay. Most of the diet in Africa is plant-based material already. The problem is often it's inferior. It's the starchy sort of, inferior vegetables. I mean, the Eat Lancet diet, that's a good example. They put this diet out, focused purely on environmental. They left 4 billion people out who couldn't access that diet because nuts and fruit, they're expensive product. Micronutrient deficiency. Any woman of year, of childbearing age was left out. Any child under the age of 5 was left out. I mean, that's why it got heavily criticized, because if you ignore the society we live in and the fact we have to balance things, then you can come up with these things and you say, oh, this is the best sustainable diet. Well, just give them water. That's very sustainable, but it's not nutritionally sufficient.
I mean,
So
all
any.
the companies and CEOs I've spoken to who produce cultivated meats and have, not one of them have said that they expect this to replace livestock. So, I mean, I don't know, you've mentioned a couple of people there who do. I haven't
Well,
heard of them. It'd be interesting to sort of get them on my on the program.
yeah, ask GFI. I mean, GFI is a pretty good proponent around the world. If you look at the things that they stack up, why we have to get rid of livestock. I mean,
Yes,
they're the
but they're not
ones
saying that we
promoting.
need to get rid of livestock. I mean,
Oh,
it's only people
they.
like kind of Petter and Compassion in World Farming who are kind of talking
I
about it.
think you'll find in the GFI documents, and we've seen this. Arguments around, livestock aren't healthy for you. Well, GBD's published their big meta-analysis in 2022 and said there are literally no data correlating with increased diseases with meat, other than heavily processed meat, the sort of salamis and things like that. So it's just, people have put out this argument. Then they put out the argument about exotic diseases, antibiotics, land utilize that, they don't bother to tell the story. Look, I'm happy to have that conversation, is that we need to actually tell the story about our food system. Livestock are a very important part. I can go out and buy a carbon neutral steak today. If I'm a farmer, I'll take, Australia I know really well, I've got land. I can put carbon into the soil, I can grow trees, I can fence my waterways. All of our industries are pushing to being more sustainable. All of our food systems must be.
Okay, well, let me ask you this question. Do you think intensive factory farming is a good way of producing meat or dairy?
Well, again, we have to get in and define what intensive is, because when I look at that and people throw around the term factory farming, and then I go in and look at their definitions of that,
Well, in America,
then
that
if it,
In America, they have the terms of CAFO, don't they? I can't remember what it
yeah.
stands for.
So let's look at dairy. I mean, dairy is intensive by nature. Okay, I can't afford to have cows walking 5 kilometers twice a day to be milked. Okay, so by definition, dairying is a relatively intense farming practice, but the product that's produced from a nutritional point of view is liquid gold. And you look at countries like India, they've got the largest dairy population in the world. Okay, we can help them on productivity because their productivity is about 4 to 6 liters per day per cow. Ours is about 20 to 30 liters, so huge potential increase on productivity gains there. Dairy cows, when we look at in Australia, we've got some of the with robotics, and you've got housing and that. The cows don't go outside. We provide ad lib food and water and fresh bedding. They're really happy inside. So again, it really comes down to, if you're a farmer, the two things you've got that really matter is land and animals. If you're in any way abusing either of those, you're not going to be in the industry. So I'm not saying there aren't some people where their practices are questionable, but you've got to look at the context. Chicken raising in Africa, okay, the village chicken. The village chicken there is slaughtered at about 18 months, okay? And it's a bit stringy in that. and it's very susceptible to diseases and predation. We grow chickens. The chicken that you is on your table, that's 6 weeks. That's 6 weeks old.
Yeah.
So we've done a lot
And it's a
on
big chicken.
genetics. Yeah, we've done a lot on genetics and feed to optimize growth rates and to optimize,
Yeah.
the quality of production. So it's really hard to sort of put, people love to put labels and go factory farms are bad. But when you actually ask them what is a factory farm,
But I mean,
most of
you're
them can't
talking about
remember.
those chickens that have been kind of genetically bred in order to produce more meat quicker as a positive thing. I mean, obviously there are lots of people kind of listening to this and in the world who see that as a bit of a travesty. It's very cruel because their legs can't take it because they're in confined
Yeah,
space.
but look,
These
we're going back a decade in genetics. The most important thing in selection of animals is feed efficiency. So some people went too hard. In dairy, we went too hard on production and we had a problem with fertility, and we've backed off that. Because if you can't get your cow pregnant, you can't really milk it. So modern genetics now is a very different story than the stories about an animal that couldn't be supported by its legs. This is sort of, stories that. So
And so
it
you
look, it
think they
just
are,
doesn't make.
and so you
Sorry?
think they're false stories, the ones
No, there
about.
are stories from a decade or more ago. There are
Right.
stories when we realized that our selection pressure was too hard in one direction and
Okay.
we need to change it. The most important selection that a farmer makes today. If I'm dairy, it's fertility. If I'm chickens, it's feed efficiency. Feed efficiency is the critical one, and feed efficiency fits into sustainability. It's why fish, it's why like aquaculture has grown so much. Aquaculture is over 50% of world seafood now is aquaculture, because the feed efficiency of fish is. They're the most efficient species we grow, and and that's why that's great. It's growing in Africa, in parts of Africa as well, because it's very, very feed efficient.
I mean, it seems to me that there's so much of science and kind of bioengineering of our animals over the years that they are becoming more and more like a bioreactor anyway, except that they are kind of living, sort of sentient creatures,
But it's the same. If you think about genetics, the biggest impact in genetics has been in crops. I mean, our genetic selection has been far greater in crops, because we can go in and effectively radiate the seeds, select out mutants, and select. So it's largely been natural, not natural selection, but heavily selected for. Now we can go in and engineer. We can engineer for disease resistance. We're now going to be able to do that for livestock. It makes a lot of sense, that we can actually engineer. We can engineer in the birds. For instance, if I want eggs, I don't want the males. Okay, we can actually engineer in to change that. So I'm a proponent of modern biotechnology. I mean, we would not be in the place we are today in the crop industry if we hadn't been able to genetically select. And now we're selecting for disease resistance in a big way. Now we're selecting for salt tolerance. We're selecting rice crop varieties that have low water needs. To me, what we need to do is actually use more of this technology. The 20 years away, years ago, people said, "Oh, it's not going to be safe." Well, we've been eating it now for decades, So I think the safety issue is largely done with,
Do you think there's any truth to the idea that this is a science, a little bit like, so are we, is it comparable perhaps to the sort of energy industry, whereby A new science is coming along that could potentially be a kind of third agricultural revolution that can really alter the way we produce food in a more effective, more humane, more environmentally friendly way. And yet there are groups of people with lots of money, really powerful people who are trying to stop that from happening. Do you think there's any truth in that?
Look, I think, genetic selection and gene editing. I mean, gene editing has been a revolution, for us. The fact, and we've got crops. The papaya industry in Hawaii was saved by gene editing in
I'm talking more
resistance.
about I'm talking more about sort of cellular agriculture and sort of cultivated meat and that sort of thing rather than
Oh, look, I think that, as I said, the problem for cultivated meat is not the tech, it's the business models. To be honest, if I want to use a high-tech product and compete in a commodity market, that's a business 101 failure, 101 failure. If I've got high tech, I want good margins to pay for that tech. So the business models just don't stack up. That I'm going to use really high tech and then I'm going to go out and compete with the commodity product. Now, some people say, oh, well, I'll make a steak, like a leaf farm. They make a steak that's 5 millimeters thick. I'm not sure how you get a medium rare 5 millimeters, maybe show it to the flame, but don't actually put it on. It just doesn't stack up, against
But
a nice.
in terms of the question that I asked, I mean, do you think there are kind of is there a pushback against the science which is
Oh, look, in Europe,
being
I mean,
funded?
the overreaction to genetic engineering has been positively hysterical in Europe, and in places like France and that, and it's held up. And I think what we're actually seeing now is a change. We're seeing it in the UK already. So the UK is now they're moving away from a lot of the bans that have we've seen in the EU, and it also doesn't make a lot of sense. I'll give you an example. I go and talk to my local Green member. I'm in an electorate where we have a Green member in federal parliament, and I talk to him about this technology, and I say, "Look, you guys like the concept of vaccination?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "So you vaccinate your children?" "Yeah." I said, so how come you can use that technology to vaccinate your infants, but you can't use that technology in agriculture? It's the same technology. The COVID vaccines would not have existed for this technology. So we have this bizarre, I mean, these aren't scientific arguments. This is the crazy thing about it. You can't make an issue and say, oh, well, we can use all these things to keep us, to vaccinate us, to keep ourselves happy, to make monoclonal antibodies, but we couldn't possibly use it in food. It doesn't make sense. It's not science, a scientific argument.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, we are. I mean, we. I could talk to you all day long, Paul,
Oh,
about it,
yeah, I'm
but
sure
we
this.
are in some ways limited by time, and it has been probably the longest interview I've done so far. I'll ask you one more question before we call it a day. I mean, why do you think there's been no further approvals in the USA for kind of cultivated meat companies since, for
Yeah, look,
a year and a half, almost 2 years.
I'm not sure why that is, but it is intriguing that they've made two approvals and no products really come to the market. There's been a few testing in restaurants and things, and largely that's because the more product you sell, the more money you lose. So, good meats or Just Eat. I mean, they pull their product off the market and seeing, of course, they're losing money. I mean, the contract manufacturer is costing $1,000 a kilogram. So even selling a chicken nugget at $20 a chicken nugget wasn't making any money. So I think largely they've come to the realization that there's no point putting product out there when you're losing money.
Well, who's
So I
come
think
to that? Who's come to that realization? These are FDA or
well,
new.
look at the two companies in the US that have got licenses now for over a year. They
Yeah,
haven't
but
put
that's got
products in the
nothing to
market.
do with new approvals. I know that there are people in the pipeline
But
now
what I'm saying is
in Hallelujah.
the companies aren't push the pressure's not on there. I mean, part of the getting those early licenses was to take the pressure off. I don't, what happens, I work with both those regulatory agencies. You put pressure on them to make decisions. I think a lot of pressure's come off because people are going, well, we're actually not ready for the market yet. In some jurisdiction, it's taking too long. In Australia, I mean, VAL's been waiting for its regulatory approval for too long. But our regulatory agencies are still learning about how to regulate this food. But to be honest, they could get 10 approvals in the US tomorrow, and no one would be selling product. I mean, it doesn't make sense to lose money on the products, and no one's at a scale or no one's at a cost of manufacture. Believer Meats is, got their scale up facility. They're the only one who's gone ahead with a scale up facility, but they make a fibroblast. I mean, that's like fibroblasts are what you trim off the edge of your steak. That's what I don't get that one at all, from a point of view of customer satisfaction.
Okay, well, we're going to have to call it quits there because it's almost an hour. It's been very illuminating and interesting to talk to you, Paul. I hope to call on you again at some point if I may, when
Yeah,
things.
no, Alex. Always nice to chat. I mean, these are complex issues. Food security is a vitally important issue. We can't afford to, whatever we do, we can't make the situation worse. We can't make food less healthy. We can't make it less available to those who really need it. So it's really, really important that we don't screw up the system.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting what they say at this COP29 as a follow-up to the last one, isn't it? I'm going to be kind of watching with curiosity.
And COP31 when you come to Australia.
Well, I mean, I haven't been to any yet, but I expect to sort of go to some soon.
I was just tonight commenting that, a meeting where 80,000 people fly in, many of them in their corporate jets, to talk about sustainability doesn't quite make a lot of sense.
And the last one was ridiculous because it was being kind of hosted by all the kind of oil barons and whatnot. So yes, quite a strange concept. But at least they were talking about food for the first time, which is
Yeah,
needs to take our
no,
eye off
it's
oil.
really important. Thanks for the time. Nice to chat, Alex.
Thank you, Paul. Have a good day.
Okay,
Bye bye.
bye.